This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 16th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Gilda Geist. We'll speak with Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from our State House reporter Katie Lannon and Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Planning for the Cape Cod Bridge's reconstruction project continues, but CAI has learned that the Bourne Bridge has been denied two major federal grants. Also this week, we talked with arts organizations on the Cape that have seen the Trump administration cancel their grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
We know that federal funding has already been committed for the Sagamore Bridge replacement, which is estimated to cost about $2.1 billion. But you've learned that the Bourne Bridge has been passed over for some comparable funding, at least for now. Explain what we know about what happened.
Sure. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation applied for some grants for the Bourne Bridge from two of the major sources that had also funded the Sagamore Bridge reconstruction project. Those are the Mega Program and the Bridge Investment Program, both federal. They did not get either of those grants, and they were big money. They were $634 million each, so a total of $1.3 billion that is not coming through for the Bourne Bridge this year. I interviewed Louisa Piwanski this week. She is the head of the bridge project for the Healey administration. She said in that interview that the mega grant had been denied and she didn't expect to win the other one either. And then later, I got an email with some more information from a DOT official saying that both were denied actually last fall.
It stands to reason that these grant denials could put the Bourne Bridge at risk for delay in construction. There's a timeline that everyone's looking at here for replacing these bridges. Do you know if that's the case? Has the timeline changed?
Well, the state is not ready to concede any kind of a delay as a result of not getting these grants. And they do have some reasons for that. Piwanski says that they're going to keep looking for other sources of funding, naturally. But beyond that, she says the permitting and design process takes a number of years, and it's already underway for both bridges at the same time. So it is conceivable that getting funding a little bit down the road for the Bourne Bridge could still allow the construction of the Bourne to start on time. On time, in this case, for the Bourne Bridge would be about 5 years from now. So they do have a little bit of time as long as they can keep moving with the planning and permitting.
Now, letters are going out this week to property owners near both of the bridges about access to their property during the construction. This is different from the eminent domain notices that already went out. Talk a little bit about this. How many people are getting these letters and what kind of access does it involve?
Right. About 1,000 property owners near both bridges are getting these letters saying that the state or companies that the state has contracted with may have to access the property temporarily for the bridge project. Generally, the access is going to be for things like doing surveying, taking photos, putting in stakes, digging test pits, things like that. But it can include tree cutting, tree removal also. And the state says it does compensate people financially for any property damage, including those trees that might be taken out. Louisa Piwanski from DOT really wanted to emphasize, though, as you said, that this new round of letters going out to a wider group is not about the taking of land. People who could be involved with those eminent domain takings were notified already.
All right, let's move on to another story about federal funding. This time it's the clawback of grants that have already been awarded by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is affecting organizations all over the country, including right here in our region. Is that right?
That's right. It is hundreds of groups across the country, according to NPR's reporting. President Trump also has proposed eliminating all funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, and it is affecting organizations here locally. These grant amounts vary, the type of projects they fund vary. A lot of times, the money goes to support emerging artists, who, in some cases, on the Cape, have actually gone on to do nationally significant work. The Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown uses National Endowment for the Arts money to support a 7-month fellowship for artists in residence. It's one of the longest in the country, according to Sharon Poley, who is the director there. And she said that just in the last 2 years, past fellows from that program have won 3 different Pulitzer Prizes, 2 for poetry, 1 for fiction.
What about some of the other grants being lost locally? Can you point to them for us?
Sure. Well, the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, which I just mentioned, lost more than $200,000 combined from the NEA and some other programs that are being cut. And the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod, which makes its own smaller grants with this money to local individual artists and cultural organizations, they lost $40,000. Leaders of these groups say they hope to make up the difference from other sources, at least in the short term, right? So, like the Arts Foundation, they're already partway through the grant making cycle for this year. They want to be able to still fund that, but they're concerned about the longer term, in part because they know that multiple groups who've lost money are all going to be going out to do fundraising all at once.
Talk a little bit about the letters that these groups received from the Trump administration and kind of the way that this messaging has been shaped about what's happening to this money.
Right. So they received these letters by email, saying that the Trump administration is directing the money from the National Endowment for the Arts to other priorities. And the letter lists about a dozen different priorities, which, for the most part, to me, don't seem to have a direct connection to the arts. The first one that's listed is actually projects that elevate historically Black colleges and universities. That could be arts related, right? If that work is arts related. But then the letter goes on to include other things like disaster relief, fostering jobs in skilled trades, and what the administration is calling the Make America Healthy Again. So, as I said before, Trump has also proposed eliminating all of the NEA funding in his budget proposal. So it's unclear what all of this could mean for these priorities. But, eliminating the agency would require congressional approval.
There's a sentence in this letter I just want to point to that says that the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, is updating its grant-making policy priorities to focus funding on projects that reflect the nation's rich artistic heritage and creativity as prioritized by the president. So this is really directly coming out of the administration and trying to pivot what is funded in this country from the arts. It's a big change from how things used to be organized around the National Endowment for the Arts. I want to talk about another story you reported this week, something hopeful happening here. It's about foster care on Cape Cod. There's a new effort to recruit more foster parents on the Cape so that children don't have to leave the area for foster care. Tell us about this.
Sure. Foster parent recruitment is done by the state, but it's also sometimes done by nonprofit groups that work with the state. And one of those groups is Boys Town New England. And they're launching a special effort for Cape Cod because they say the Cape does not have enough foster homes. And the result of that is that often children who need foster care have to be placed off Cape, sometimes going a long way from the schools they've attended and from parental visitation. I should point out that what Boys Town New England typically does is called comprehensive foster care, which is a little different from what you think of as standard foster care, and it comes with additional supports for children who need it. So they are doing recruiting on the Cape. But about that issue of kids being forced to go off Cape, CAI has a public records request pending with the state to find out exactly how many children really have to do that. But according to Boys Town, it is a really considerable problem.
But local folks here on the Cape are already involved in this recruitment effort to get more people to step forward for foster homes for kids. Is that right? How is that working?
Yes. So a group of Cape residents has formed kind of this ad hoc committee to work on adding foster placements on the Cape. And one of the leaders of that is Linda Zammer. She's a business owner on the Cape and a philanthropist. And what this group would like to do sometime in the future is to establish what she's calling a transition home, where children who are waiting for a longer term foster placement could go, so it would allow them to remain on the Cape. And it would still be a home type setting with foster parents, but it could possibly take up to four children. One thing that's good about that is it also could help siblings stay together instead of being split into foster homes, which is a common problem. In the short term, though, this committee on the Cape, and Linda Zammer and her group, they are working with Boys Town on the Boys Town project, which is a little bit of a simpler plan that's not about establishing a permanent transition home on the Cape, but it is recruiting new foster families here. And Boys Town is planning to be giving talks at community groups to raise awareness of the need for foster families. So the local volunteers are kind of helping them to connect with organizations that would be receptive to having these presentations to raise awareness. And their goal is to recruit between 5 and 10 new foster families by the end of this year.
That's CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Late yesterday, we got word that Juan Francisco Mendez has been released on bail. His arrest in New Bedford when federal agents smashed through his car window made national news as the video went viral. CAI's Gilda Geist has an update on the case and joins us. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Steve.
Start with the latest. Mendez was being held in a facility in New Hampshire. There was even a question about whether a hearing would happen yesterday. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, so up until yesterday, Mendez was being held at Stratford County Corrections in New Hampshire. A judge actually ordered his release last week, but when his lawyer called the jail and called ICE, that's U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they said they couldn't release him because his case ID number didn't match the number on the judge's order. Mendez actually seemed to have three different ID numbers, his lawyer found, when he should have had just one. Interestingly, the judge who ordered Mendez's release last week kept his bond hearing that was scheduled for yesterday, May 15th, just in case he didn't end up being let out. And that's exactly what happened. So that bond hearing was under one of those differing case ID numbers. And so the lawyer, Ondine Galvez-Sniffen, was worried that even if the judge set bail and they paid it, Mendez still wouldn't be let out. But Sniffen called me yesterday afternoon and told me that Mendez had indeed departed the New Hampshire Corrections Facility.
This all comes after an extraordinary month in which Mendez was held but never charged.
Yeah, so Mendez had that hearing last week. That's when the judge ordered his release. And that day, the judge declared what's called a failure to prosecute. That's like the legal jargon way of saying that basically the government didn't charge him with any crimes. So leading up to the hearing, Sniffen was really at a loss trying to get in contact with ICE and the courts to figure out why her client was being detained, since he hadn't been charged with anything and he had no criminal record. Then, of course, because of the ID number thing, he was still held. Now, since that hearing, Sniffen has told me that Mendez has finally been formally charged. He is charged with being present in the United States without documentation. He'll have to go back to court for that, but we don't know when yet.
Remind us of some of the circumstances around his arrest, because this captured so much attention.
Yeah, it got all that attention because his wife, who was with him at the time, got a video of the arrest, which blew up online because, to be honest, it's pretty shocking to see. Mendez and his wife, Mary Lou, they're in their car. Federal agents block their way with their vehicles. They approach the car and they demand they open the door. And the couple tells them they will just once their lawyer arrives and she's on her way. And that's Sniffen. So while they were waiting, one of the federal agents used, it looks like an axe or like a pick, to smash through the car window. Mary Lou says they dragged them both out of the car by force without ever showing them a warrant, which they asked for. Mendez's wife and son have asylum, and the family was in the process of getting Mendez derivative asylum, which is basically where family members can apply for asylum through family members who already have that status. So that case is still pending.
Gilda, another story you reported on this week. The website has disappeared for a high-profile and long-standing effort by local science institutions to promote more diversity in science. This is, or it was, the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative.
Yeah, so we knew the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative had paused the group's activities following the Trump administration's rollbacks to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. That's something they announced earlier this year, so we knew that. But the website being gone, that's new. So up until last Friday, the website was at the URL woodsholediversity.org, and it was hosted by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And that website just had information about the history of the group, as well as educational programs and resources related to DEI. Notably, you used to be able to use this website to access what's called the Livingston Report. This is a report that the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative commissioned from Dr. Robert Livingston. He's a scholar of diversity issues at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And that 2018 report basically identified ways the science community here could be more inclusive in recruitment and hiring. You can still find this report online just by searching Livingston Report Woods Hole. But on the whole, anything from the website that can still be accessed online is pretty much completely decentralized.
There was a lot of information at this website, which has now disappeared. You reached out to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about this. What did they tell you?
Yeah, so in the statement Huey gave me for this story, it's interesting. It seems to have kind of like a greater sense of finality than the statement the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative originally put out. I'll explain what I mean by that. The original statement used the word pause, right? Pausing the group activities. That pretty heavily implies that the initiative will at some point resume its work. But the statement I got from Huey this week reads a little differently. It says, quote, "The site had not been actively maintained following the winding down of the committee's activities," unquote. The statement goes on to say that HUI and the other science institutions remain committed to, quote, "exploring new collaborative efforts to support similar initiatives in the future," unquote. So I don't know, that word winding down, it seemed a little more final than pause, but it's hard to say what this all means for the future of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative. We'll have to wait and see what happens.
Painful, I imagine, for many of the people who put so many hours into that to see all that work not only stopped, but essentially wiped off the internet. That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. No single answer exists for the region's housing crisis, but on Martha's Vineyard, there's hope that a new building bylaw could help move things in the right direction. Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with more details. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Sarah, you've taken a close look here at what's known as accessory dwelling units, or ADUs. This new bylaw from the state is intended to encourage the building of ADUs. Explain, what kind of spaces are we talking about?
Well, what's really cool about ADUs is that there's a lot of different spaces they could end up being. So from a lofted apartment above a garage, small, separate from the primary home. And some people may already have these, but ADUs in this bylaw are different because of their definition. But think secondary structure, apartment, kitchen, bathroom, the works. There are restrictions on square footage and wastewater capacity based on the size of the primary dwelling and specifics in each town. The state's restrictions are that these units can be half the square footage of the primary home or 900 square feet, whichever is greater. But these accessory units have a really broad reach within that framework, which makes them accessible for a variety of structures. And homeowners can get really creative with the types of apartments they decide to build, depending on whether they're providing for a new renter or a family member.
The state has now changed regulations to encourage these accessory dwelling units. Is that right? That's part of what's happening here.
Yeah, so the Affordable Homes Act signed accessory dwelling units as a protected use by right building option into law last year, pioneered by Governor Maura Healey and her team. And that basically means that municipalities aren't allowed to get over-involved in the permitting process. So while they do need to be submitted for approval, it's now a homeowner's right to build one of these on an existing property. So the permitting process is way easier than it previously was for any secondary unit. And when we looked at other states that have passed similar laws about ADUs and saw the effects on affordable housing stock there, it was shocking how quickly their situation changed. So So the state of California is a pretty common example. They passed a similar law to Massachusetts, but they pioneered it in 2016. And over the past 9 years, their housing landscape has completely changed. And now one in five of every dwelling in California is an ADU.
This is intended, as we said, to help with the housing crunch. Have island towns responded? How have island towns sort of embraced this bylaw?
So every town besides Aquinnah added the law to their warrants with a few amendments. The towns all adopted an optional amendment provided by the state, which prohibits these units from being used as short-term rentals. Mm. So any ADU that's built on the island won't be able to be rented out to visitors for a few weeks out of the year, and therefore won't be a contributing factor to our tourism economy. Instead, the units will theoretically contribute to year-round housing stock for our workers, residents, people of all ages. And a few towns went even further. So Chilmark, for instance, decided to lift restrictions on size, and any homeowner in that town will now be able to build an ADU up to 900 feet, no matter the size of their primary home.
I think one of the interesting angles that you examine is that the way that ADUs can foster a kind of intergenerational family living, and you kind of looked at some existing comparable structures to tease this out. Explain that.
Yeah, it's no secret that intergenerational living is on the rise in many areas, and the Cape and Islands are definitely no exception. With really high costs and low supply, there are a lot of adult children that are living at home. When the median home cost is $1.5 million and the average young person is at a starting salary in their careers, buying a house isn't even on their radar. So the next generation too, grandparents, are choosing to age in place more often as well, since elderly assisted living apartments have such a long wait list, and they're still very expensive. So we spoke to four families on the island who live in these intergenerational living situations, and they all have separate dwellings for their family members who live with them. Their stories really illustrate a possible future for ADUs in the sense that the generations live separately, but together still on the same property in this adapted situation. And one of these families, the Douglases, took their home build one step further and built sustainably. And now the retired couple and the younger generation, their daughter, live in a net zero, environmentally friendly two-structure home.
It's a fascinating story with a lot of interesting profiles built into it. It's by Sarah Shaw Dawson. You can find it at the website of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Chatham and Orleans held town meetings this past week. There were plenty of spending items for voters to weigh in on. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has some more details for us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start in Chatham, where the Council for Active Living scored a win this time around.
Yeah, it was a big win, actually. As we've talked about in the past, numerous occasions, town meeting has failed to appropriate money to build a new Center for Active Living, a senior center for the Council on Aging. But after retooling the plans to involve basically expanding the existing facility and upgrading it for a $5 million price tag, voters went for that big time. They passed it 440-88. So that will be happening over the next year. The officials hope to fast track this project and get the new facility open in about a year.
Tell us about some of the other actions that happened at Chatham Town Meeting. They were also looking at the Monomoy Middle School repairs that are on the mm-hmm. agenda.
Sure. There are a number of significant actions taken at the meeting. Number one, as you said, the town approved the $9 million replacement of siding and windows at the middle school, the Monomoy Middle School, which is located here in Chatham. intrusion of water into the building had caused some air quality problems there, so officials are trying to move fast to fix that. Harwich also approved that expenditure, so that project will be going forward. Chatham also appropriated $3.4 million to complete renovations and reconfigurations at its transfer station, as well as approving $32 million to continue with the town's sewer expansion program. And another major article wasn't a money article, but it was certainly controversial, involved the town's airport. And it was a petition article that proposed to ban aircraft with wingspans larger than 49 feet from the airport. And that article passed by a very narrow margin, about 26 votes. It could end up being turned down by the attorney general, because both the town council and the airport's attorney have said that the bylaw is not legal. Voters overrode those recommendations, however, and we'll just have to wait until the attorney general has a chance to review this and see whether it's approved or not.
Tim, in Orleans, voters approved funds to design a new fire station. That seemed to be the big ticket on the agenda.
Indeed. You know, there's been a lot of discussions in Orleans about the fire station. It was originally built in 1987, and it no longer really meets the needs of a modern fire department. The vote was pretty much overwhelmingly in favor of appropriating $4.5 million to begin a design process for that facility. Officials in Orleans have talked about a new fire station as one component of a town campus along Eldridge Park Way that would include the elementary school and possibly a community center. So this will be sort of the kickoff of that. Although it was a bit controversial, voters did back it at a pretty good margin.
That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Hiring a new police chief for a town is something bigger than just filling a job opening. A new chief can do a lot to reset the tone and interactions in the town. Provincetown just hired a new chief as a result of a very deliberate process. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us who the new chief is, and then we can talk about why this feels like a significant move.
Sure. So... Lieutenant Greg Hennick is who the town picked. He was the second in command of the police department. But there was this very extensive 5-month process. They put out a nationwide search. There were a search committee of town residents from kind of all walks of life who had the chance to interview all the candidates. And then the finalists went through this assessment exercise that other police chiefs graded them on their capacity to respond to different kinds of situations. So it really... they went through a very elaborate process to, in the end, conclude that they did believe the lieutenant was going to be able to be an excellent chief.
Part of this comes because he's replacing a police chief that there was some controversial feelings around within the town, and a sense that they wanted to really make sure that if they were going to select somebody from within the department, some of the issues that had been there were not necessarily just going to be continued. Is that right? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's right. The select board had been very dissatisfied with the current police chief. They said it pretty often. They called him a sort of imperial force who governed with a heavy hand and didn't want to interact with anybody outside the station, the select board, other town departments, other parts of civil society. So he didn't show up to a lot of meetings. In fact, you very rarely saw him in public. So they had a lot of problems with that.
I'm curious about the process. So in selecting the new chief, they created a search committee that really seemed to involve a wide aspect of the town. Like a lot of people got a chance to weigh in here. Talk about that.
Yeah, they made sure that the search committee was diverse racially. It was diverse in terms of professional background. There was a Unitarian minister who was one of the people. The Board of Health Chair, who's a former lawyer, was on there. They kind of wanted to make sure that the parents of some high school age children or now college age children were on there. There had been some incidents at a basketball court at which the police came in really hot and put a 14 or 15 year old in handcuffs while they searched his bag. So they wanted to make sure that they were interviewing for really to make sure that people had some understanding of racial diversity, of the diversity of life experiences in Provincetown. It is a very unusual place, and they just wanted to make sure they had someone who was excited about that instead of unenthusiastic.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Chief Hennick, the new chief coming in. He had a lot to say about the ways in which he really believes the Provincetown Police Department has a commitment to interacting with the community.
Yeah, he definitely wants the officers out on Commercial Street a lot more, on bicycle and on foot. He wants them to know more about the Human Services Departments, Bay Cove, which provides mental health services. There are other parts of the, you know, the Council on Aging, the Health Department, Outer Cape Health Services, the Navigator Program, things that people can go to get help when they're struggling. Like, he's like, I know what these resources are, but I want all my officers to know exactly who to point people to if they look like they're struggling, which is not always something you hear every day. So that was interesting. We put that in the paper. And then he's also going to some meetings with J1 students. There was an issue not that long ago where J1 students had a problem with their landlord, and they were really just referred to take it to court. And he's like, you know, there could have been a lot more proactive advice given on, like, here's the health department. They're in charge of rental housing. They're the ones you want to be talking to if you're having a struggle with your rental, rather than just telling them to drive to Orleans and file a claim.
New chief gets going. He's already on the job. Is that right?
Yeah, he actually took over as acting chief on March 1st. So towards the end of this search process, he was acting chief and going through the rigorous interviews, which he said he was glad that's over, but also grateful for it because, you know, you go through a rigorous process, you come out with people functionally. It's like the search committee is behind him. They're the ones who recommended him. So he felt it was worthwhile.
That is Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Nantucket has an election on Tuesday. On the ballot, there are candidates, funding questions, and an issue of governance. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror can explain it all. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
The contested races here for the select board. Tell us a little bit about those and what else voters will be asked to decide.
Sure. There are five candidates up for two seats on the select board in Tuesday's election. They offer a wide range of perspectives on some of the most pressing issues facing the island right now, from affordable housing and offshore wind to management of our landfill and the structure of town government. The field includes two incumbents, Something Natural Bread Bakery and sandwich shop owner Matt Fee, and Brooke Moore, who is currently the chair of the select board, and she has a background in social work and bookkeeping, and three challengers, 15-time candidate Cliff Williams, and newcomers Brooke Gibbs, who is a property manager and caretaker, and Nantucket Residents Against Turbines co-founder Mary Chalk. In other races, former Historical Commission Chair Hillary Rayport, who drafted a home rule petition that's twice been approved at town meeting seeking to change the structure of the Nantucket Planning and Economic Development Commission, and is currently before the state legislature, is facing real estate agent Liza Hatton for a one-year seat on the planning board, and Nantucket Sustainability Manager Vincent Murphy and Equity Fund Manager Matthew Terra are running for a seat on the school committee. Murphy has been in that seat for a few months now. He was filling out the remainder of the term after Pauline Proach stepped down last year. There's also a handful of ballot questions to be decided, including a $134 million appropriation for the construction of a new town-owned nursing home. But that proposal was defeated at town meeting, so this would only be one step in the process if it's approved. Some select board members have said that if the vote is overwhelmingly in favor at the polls, they would push to revisit that nursing home construction at a special town meeting in the fall. And there's also a non-binding question on whether the town should switch from the open town meeting form of government to a town council form of government. Despite a couple years ago, voters at town meeting pretty handily requesting that a group be formed to explore a town council form of government. This most recent town meeting a couple of weeks ago, the same kind of non-binding question failed by a sizable margin.
Josh, let me ask you about another story. The Nantucket Wine and Food Festival made news last year with a battle over a takeover attempt. Now the festival is back. How's it look and feel?
So far, so good from what we've been able to tell. It got started on Wednesday night. It runs through Sunday. It is the original Nantucket Wine and Food Festival. They were able to fight off a challenge, a takeover attempt. They have some new venues. They're largely going to be headquartered at Bartlett's Farm and the Nantucket Hotel this year instead of the White Elephant Hotel, as they had been for about a decade. It's pretty much 4 days of wine dinners, wine tastings, wine talks, different, a bunch of chefs come down as well. It's the first festival of the season. We had Daffodil Weekend back at the end of April, but the wine festival kicks off the festival season coming up. We've got the Nantucket Book Festival, the Nantucket Film Festival, the Nantucket Garden Festival, but this is really sort of the kickoff to the summer season, even before Memorial Day weekend.
As we talk about firsts of the season, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but you had a story in the paper this week as well about the first white shark of the season confirmed off of Nantucket. Can you give us just a few details there?
Sure. I don't know that it's any surprise to anyone that there are sharks around Nantucket. There have been for quite some time. This, I think, is the first time that the first white shark of the season in New England waters was spotted off Nantucket, and it was actually spotted off the South Shore. Whoever spotted it found a saw a seal that had obviously been chomped on by something. It turned out it was a white shark. The New England Aquarium, the White Shark Conservancy, confirmed that it was a white shark. White sharks are back, and everyone urging swimmers and people who go to the beach to be on the lookout. There's a lot in the water there that you might not necessarily be aware of.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time now for news from the State House. A new Republican candidate has entered the race for governor, and he has a Cape connection. Also this week, the state introduces an online tool that shows funding cuts to state programs coming from the Trump administration. Earlier, I spoke with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, about those stories and more. Hi, Katie.
Hey there.
Let's start with Brian Shortsleeve, the Republican candidate who's enlisted for a chance to challenge Governor Maura Healey in 2026. He is a former Marine, and he does have a Cape connection. Tell us more about him.
Former Marine, as you say, now a venture capitalist who lives out there in Barnstable. He is probably, if his name is familiar to folks within Massachusetts, it's from his time running the T under former Governor Charlie Baker, who brought him in really to clean house after that battering winter of 2015 really strained the system. Now, we'll probably see a lot of commentary on the T, here in the Boston area, at least, as we prepare for this governor's race, whether he fixed it or whether that was Governor Healey who really has righted the ship over there.
And in this kickoff week of his campaign, he's been talking a lot about transparency issues.
Yeah, that's right. He supports State Auditor Diana DeSaglio in her bid to open up the books of the state legislature. Not super surprising. She ran that ballot campaign to get that power with support of a lot of Republicans who really want more transparency from the Democratic supermajorities that run the legislature. And I asked him this week, too, if he would be interested in opening up the governor's records. The governor's office is not subject to the state public records law in Massachusetts. He says that's something he would support, applying that law to the governor's office if he was elected, because transparency is important, and he thinks the voters have a right to know what's going on.
Let me ask you about Governor Healey's administration rolling out an online dashboard that aims to show the impact of federal funding cuts on Massachusetts. These are just cuts at the state level, not at county or town levels. What's behind this, and what are some of the big takeaways from what this dashboard shows?
Massachusetts really relies on federal money to fill out its state budget here. There's about $16 billion in the budget that's under debate now, and that's money that if it goes away, the state can't afford to fill in those gaps. So the governor is looking to really highlight what the Trump administration has pulled back from Massachusetts as it shifts the way the federal government approaches sending money to the states. And so we've seen on this dashboard outlining things like some of the COVID relief money that is still unspent by local school districts. That's something that has been cut under the Trump administration, along with some money for children's vaccinations, some money for disaster preparedness. And as she's charting these kind of statewide funding cuts, the governor is also asking cities and businesses and nonprofits to let the state know if they're seeing grants frozen or other problems there. Kind of a marketing campaign almost to highlight the impact of these federal cuts at a time when the state is really feeling such a squeeze on its own budget that the governor just announced a hiring freeze for state jobs this week.
Also this week, the governor filed an act aimed at bringing down the cost of living in Massachusetts, specifically trying to address household and business utility bills.
I don't think anyone really needs a reminder how big a blow this winter's utility bills were for many people. And that's something the governor has been trying to tackle in a number of different ways. And this bill she's filed this week is the latest effort. It looks to take some of the extra non-delivery related charges off of utility bills to find savings that way and boost the supply of electricity, in part by making it easier to stand up kind of small scale nuclear power efforts here in Massachusetts, which face more barriers currently than other types of electricity projects.
And finally, Katie, the Massachusetts Senate has approved a supplemental budget to spend about $1 billion in extra revenue coming from the so-called millionaires tax. Explain that and what some of that money will be going toward.
So this is money that's already been collected under the state's new tax on million-dollar incomes, but hasn't been budgeted or spent yet. So the House and the Senate are each looking to allocate this billion-dollar plus pool of money to different one-time education and transportation projects. The Senate's plan really looks to build capacity for vocational education. So there's money there that would support those schools as they make more space to get people off of wait lists for seats in the schools. There's money in both bills for the MBTA, though the Senate, which likes to talk about focusing regionally on transportation rather than just on the T, has less in there than the House does, and they want to also include money for local roads and regional transit. There's also money in there that would help Massachusetts get ready to host some World Cup games next summer with transportation improvements ahead of the 2026 soccer matches.
That is our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
You are listening to the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Public school teachers in New Bedford are negotiating a new contract, and they have a couple of issues they're putting front and center. Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Steve.
Colin, the current contract isn't up until July, but at a recent school committee meeting, teachers turned out in force, picketing outside. A big issue here is the ask for paid family leave, which businesses in the state are required to supply. Is that right?
That's right. And like you said, even though this isn't the contract isn't expiring until July, these teachers are showing up in force. There's 100 of them standing outside Monday's school committee meeting to demonstrate that they're really looking for and are serious about paid parental leave as a policy that they want added to their contracts. In the past few years, that's been something that there have been teacher strikes over in Massachusetts. In Beverly, Marblehead, Gloucester, Newton, teachers have striked and won the right for paid parental leave, which is something that most Massachusetts workers have enjoyed by law since 2021. But teachers and municipal workers are exempt because the state law can't force towns and cities to provide that same benefit.
You spoke with some of the teachers there about what they have to do right now that right now they don't have paid parental leave, and some of the ways that they're trying to navigate the system and what it really means to how it impacts them not having it right now.
Yeah, their stories showed a tremendous dedication to building families and to their jobs as teachers. Some of the teachers who spoke at the public comment period before the school committee told the members that in some cases they had saved up sick days for 6 years, in another case for 8 years. In many other cases, teachers are picking up part-time jobs and still don't have enough to support their families. And the paid family leave would give teachers a lot more flexibility to start families, to have time off when their children get sick, and hearing how long it takes and how much planning it takes. One teacher commented to the school committee that it feels like parents are being punished for taking care of their family.
As you said, this has been an issue that has been popping up in school districts around the state, in part because school teachers, public school teachers, are employees of towns, which are one of the bodies that are exempt from offering this to their employees. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Since 2021, most communities or most people in the state have had employer-provided parental leave. That was part of a law that was originally passed in 2018. It was known as the grand bargain that, besides instituting paid family leave, also raised the minimum wage. But as you said, municipal employees are exempt because the state can't force cities and towns to pay its employees at a certain rate. So teachers have not been enjoying the paid parental leave benefits that most Massachusetts residents have been for a number of years now. And they're looking through these collective bargaining actions to make sure they get that right as well.
I know that we've been seeing this same issue playing out locally on Nantucket as well, with teachers really pushing to get the paid family leave here. Explain how this works in terms of the whole contract that teachers in New Bedford are looking to renegotiate, and what how the, there's other issues they're also looking to package into this contract.
Yeah, absolutely. So 3 years is the term for a given teacher contract in New Bedford. So what they're arguing for and negotiating now will be the basis for their salary and any raises over the next years, including these extra benefits, including, paid parental leave, health insurance, things like that. It's been since 2022, since the last contract was negotiated. So in addition to these benefits that they're arguing for, which was probably the main feature of what teachers said to the school committee was what they were really passionate about, are also the salary raises that are part of any contract negotiation. Mm. Right now, teachers in New Bedford have been offered 2% raises. I think in the first year, actually, it's 2.25%. But then after that, 2% raises each year of the contract, and they're saying that they think they deserve more to keep up with cost of living adjustments. And those are pretty typical negotiations back and forth for any contract negotiation, negotiating about the percentage raises. But the paid parental leave is something that they were speaking about and hoping to win for the first time. And I think it marks something that's different about these negotiations compared to previous rounds.
Colin, I only have about 30 seconds, but I want to ask you what the school committee's response has been to all of this.
Yeah, the school committee didn't come out and comment, but I was able to connect with the district representatives, and they said that they feel pretty confident. They've been investing in teachers, and they think that a retention rate in the upper 80% compares favorably to other mid-sized cities. And they're hoping that through these negotiations, they can retain strong teacher retention, and they look forward to doing that, but didn't say specifics about what they'll be bringing forward in the next round of negotiating.
It's Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. Colin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Gilda Geist. We spoke with Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We were joined by our State House reporter Katie Lannon and Colin Hogan there from the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. He's the only one I know who could get Hal to open the pod bay doors. Machines just do his bidding. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.